From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. Doug Fabrizio, in his new book about Utah snow, Jim Steinberg identifies the moment the legend was born. December 4th, 1960, a young editor for the Salt Lake Tribune, Tom Korologos, inspired by a recent visit from the circus, described Utah ski conditions as the greatest snow on Earth. And of course, it stuck. Just look at a license plate. But, and this is a big but, is it true? Technically speaking, does Utah have the best snow for skiing, the best powder in the world? Steinberg is our guest today. He's an atmospheric scientist, an avid Utah skier, and his book is his attempt to set the record straight, to look at the real science and see how it matches up with the hype and the myths. Utah does have amazing snow, but why? Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you ski and you have friends in Colorado or Washington, you've probably had more than a few arguments about who has the best snow for skiing. And some of you have the spiel down pat, which may go something like this. Our snow, our powder, is special. It's lighter and it's drier than other places because we live in a desert. And deserts dry out snow. And not only that, we have this massive lake in a big valley that fuels these snowstorms. We call it the lake effect, and that is why we have the greatest snow on Earth. So, is that true? Jim Steinberg is here today to help us understand all of this. He's a professor of atmospheric science at the University of Utah, so he's got that going for him. He also happens to be an avid skier, both backcountry and resort. So he knows epic powder when he sees it. He's written a book called Secrets of the Greatest Snow on Earth, and he's joining us today, and we invite you to join the conversation as well. 801-585-WEST is our number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd like to also hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. Here's some of the questions to think about. How do you describe what's special about Utah's snow to your skiing buddies outside the state? Have you recently noticed anything different about Utah's snow? Changes in the conditions, the snowpack, the frequency of the storms. And of course, are you worried about what climate change may mean for Utah snow? 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join the conversation. Email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Jim Steinberg is a professor of atmospheric science at the University of Utah, as I said. He maintains a blog called Wasatch Weather Weenies about snowstorms and mountain weather. And he's joining us here in the studio. And Jim Steinberg, welcome.
Thanks, Doug. Great to be here.
Thanks for being with us. Well, I wanted to back up a little bit before we get to the particulars. You're from upstate New York.
Yep. I grew up in the Adirondack Mountains.
Is that where you learned to ski then?
That's where I learned to ski, yes.
So how did you describe your ski experience in growing up as a kid?
Well, from somebody who's lived in Utah for 18 years now, it was a pretty bad ski experience.
Yeah.
Adirondack Mountains are beautiful, and there's a lot of great reasons to be there. But from a ski perspective, you're always starved for snow. And that's one of the things that got me excited about snow and about the weather and how I got to this path that led me to Utah and ultimately to write this book.
It's funny, you've talked about your affection isn't just for snow. It seems like the thing that you love is just winter storms in the mountains.
Yeah, I often tell people that most of my life I've been skiing or studying winter storms, and the rest I've just wasted. I love to be in storms. Last winter, we were back in New York looking at lake effect storms. There's a place in New York called the Tug Hill Plateau that sees the most intense snowstorms in the world. There's no skiing there. It's very flat.
Yeah.
You know, you can go cross-country skiing, but no real downhill skiing. I had the time of my life. We had one storm that produced over 40 inches of snow in 24 hours, and it was an amazing experience.
What is it about a winter storm that you are intrigued by?
I don't know. I like the peacefulness of it. The harder it's snowing, the happier I am. And I just think also being a skier, just the excitement of knowing, hey, tomorrow we're going to be skiing this stuff. That's a great thing to experience.
You tell the story when you were, your dad gave you this graduation present, 86, I think it was.
Yes.
Let's go out west and ski.
Yeah.
Was this your first experience back here?
It was my first experience in the interior west. I'd skied at Squaw Valley in the in the spring snow, but I'd never skied Western snow. And we came here in January of 86. We skied Snow Basin and Alta and Park City, skied Alta a couple times. And I got that bluebird day with 18 new at Alta. And once you have a day like that, you're like, I'm not living in the Eastern United States any longer.
Really? That you were totally, seriously, you were really hooked by
I was pretty hooked then. That was my first year of college. I went to Penn State, which is even worse for snow than upstate New York.
Right.
I got a great education there, but as soon as I was done with my bachelor's degree, I was moving to the West.
What was the point at which, because you mentioned this in the book, in the introduction, that this was the trip that made you wonder about snow. What were you thinking? What about it? How does it work? Why is this so much better than the stuff I knew before? Is that what you were thinking?
Yeah, like as a meteorologist, this phrase, greatest snow on Earth, it just makes you wonder. I mean, what makes Utah snow so great? Does it really hold up to scientific scrutiny? And so that was one of the things I thought about. And really, when I wrote the book, before I wrote this book, about 5 or 6 years ago, I wrote an article for a science journal talking about why Utah snow is so great and talking about why it's not the reasons that people think, the reasons you talked about earlier. It's not that the snow here is exceptionally dry. It's the way we get it and how it makes for great powder skiing.
We're going to break that down as we go. So I guess the thing, though, I wonder about is, was part of this, you've been exploring the science, you've written about the science, now you wanted to sort of, I think the way you describe it in your book, you want to set the record straight.
Right.
Because there are all these weird ideas out there and myths, and you want to sort of figure out how much of that is true, how much of that is not.
Yeah, part of the book is to kind of expose some of the myths and talk about what really makes Utah snow so great. And you know, it's not that it's exceptionally dry snow. Parts of Colorado, Steamboat Springs, for example, gets drier snow than Alta does. Parts of the Great Lakes of the eastern United States, on average, get drier snow than Utah.
Yeah.
And what makes things so special here, especially in the Cottonwood Canyons, is that we get a lot of snow. It snows over 500 inches a year at Alta. We get lots of these what I call Goldilocks storms that are not too big, they're not too small. They produce the right amounts of snow for a good deep powder day. And then the snow comes stacked in the right way.
Yeah.
So it starts off higher density. The storms tend to be warmer to start, and then they get colder over time. And that's really what you want for optimal ski flotation, because it gives you higher density snow to start and lower density snow, and that allows the ski to plane up through the snow properly. That's a lot better than upside-down storms, which we get sometimes, where the lighter snow starts and then it gets heavier over time. And that's why, you know, Alta became the birthplace of deep powder skiing in the world. It didn't happen in Europe, even though everybody was skiing there. They just don't get deep powder as frequently as we do, nor do they get it as good as we do all the time. So that's why this is the place to be for deep powder skiing.
Yeah. When did we come up with, I mentioned this in the introduction before, that this was 1960 when Tom Korologos first coins the phrase greatest snow on Earth. And you write a little bit about that in the book, but that sort of led to, so we know it's great, but we never knew why it was great. Again, as you said, a lot of us figured, oh, it's a desert and it's the lake, and we'll talk about all of that too, but I guess that's where the myth started in some ways.
To some degree, it's actually a good story how that phrase was developed. Hunting it down wasn't easy. The state was sued by the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus over that trademark. And I figured that with all the high-powered lawyers and money that was involved, somebody would have found the original source of the phrase. And I went through all the court documents, and it turns out that they hadn't. And I thought, well, geez, how am I going to find it? And it turns out I had a few friends that have been around for a while. And one of them told me that a guy named Mike Korologos knows the story. And I'm not very good at cold calling people, so I put off calling him for the longest time. The book was almost done, and I ran into him at a party. And
wow.
I asked him, I said, where did greatest snow on Earth come from? And he said, oh, my brother came up with it. And I thought, oh, that's a good story, but who knows? But I called his brother up, and sure enough, he said he was a writer for the Salt Lake Tribune in the late 50s and early 60s. And lo and behold, they had to put their ski edition out in November.
Yeah.
And he said, well, the circus was in town. And I just thought it would be a great phrase to put together. And that's the history of it. So that's when the legend was born.
Yeah.
But it does hold water. I mean, you can't really show scientifically that snow's the greatest on Earth. It's really in the eye of the beholder.
Of course.
But there's very few places in the world that gets as much snow as we do, with the quality that we do, with the frequency that we do. So it's pretty safe to say that Utah is one of the greatest deep powder regions in the world. The northern Wasatch, or the central Wasatch, are really the one of the great epicenters for that.
So it is special snow.
I think here it is, yes.
I wonder if, and which we'll come to this a little bit later in the program. Did part of this book come about because of concerns about global warming and global climate change and what that's going to mean? Because a lot of people fret about that.
Yeah, I added a chapter on global warming in part to kind of set the record straight on that as well. And it's definitely a serious concern. The planet's warming, and there's a lot of evidence now showing that humans are the cause. But that wasn't the main thrust of the book. And I thought it was important to add a chapter on that. But most of the book is about the things that I love about Utah skiing or deep powder skiing anywhere in the world, which is, you know, snow crystals and avalanches and everything that I think is really interesting and exciting about winter storms and mountain weather.
Well, let's start because you have a kind of a primer in your book about sort of the science of a snowstorm. And I wanted to maybe back up there because you lay out what you call this five-step plan for a snowstorm, which is kind of this stew of cloud droplets, ice particles, snowflakes, you've got wind, you've got turbulence. What are the dynamics that come into play for a snowstorm?
Well, the hard part is there's so many dynamics that come into play. It's an incredibly complicated thing that happens in a cloud to produce snow. When people think of snow, they oftentimes think of these beautiful, you know, the Alta logo with the six armed, it's called a stellar dendrite snowflake. Those type of snowflakes only form in certain environments, and in particular environments where you don't have a lot of cloud droplets, this super cooled water. Water doesn't actually freeze at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. It can get a lot colder than that before it freezes. So clouds are this stew of these super cooled cloud droplets and ice particles, and the ice particles can grow, and if they grow mostly by water vapor condensing into ice, then you get these snowflakes like these six-armed or different types too. You can get plates and other types of shapes. But another thing that happens in winter storms is what we call riming, which is when these cloud droplets collide with these ice particles, and then you can get stuff that looks like what we call grapple, which looks like a styrofoam ball. It's kind of soft and squishy. It doesn't really look like a snowflake at all, although it can ski really great. So there's all these different processes that operate in winter storms, especially over the mountains.
So what is the stuff we get? You call it a snowflake habit.
Habit, yes. Habit is a name for the type of snowflake
like
that
shape
you're looking at. Right. So that six-armed snowflake that you see with the Alta bumper stickers or whatever, that's called We get some of those. Those are called stellar dendrites. If you were out this weekend, you probably saw quite a few of those. They were falling. Then there's also things called plates, sector plates, and these tend to be more hexagonal. So they have six sides, but they don't have these arms that come out of them. And there are needles and columns. These are more kind of elongated ones, so basically, they look like needles. And so it depends. You know, there's as many as 80 or even more than that different types of snowflakes when you break it down. I usually just try to think about a few of them because I can't remember 80 names.
Right. But when you're out in the storm, do you like hold out your glove?
Yes.
And see what lands on it and say, okay, this is what this is.
Yeah, that's what I do. Like if you catch me on a chairlift and it's snowing, people are looking at me like, what's wrong with this guy? I'm looking at the crystals and I'm also thinking about the storm and what are the processes that produce that particular type of crystal. And it gives me a lot of ideas for my research, actually.
Yeah. So. One of the ideas in the book is, as you said, exposing the myths about snow. So I want to back up and go there. The idea that it's lighter or drier. Which it's not, lighter and drier than other places. But let's talk about snow water content, because you write about this. The density of snow depends on the water content. So talk a little bit about that, and then how do we determine the water content of new snow?
Right. So water content is just how much of the snowflake or the snow that's on the ground, how much of it is water that's in the ice or the liquid form, and how much of it is air, okay? So snowflakes have lots of pores and gaps. So when you have snow on the ground, it's comprised of water that's frozen and air, and sometimes water that can be liquid if you're in a warmer storm. So the water content is just how much of the snow is water and ice. And so when you have snow that's, say, 10% water content, that means it's 10% water that's either frozen or liquid phase, and it's 90% air, 90% gaps in air columns and stuff like that. On average, at Alta, the water content of snow is 8.4%. And I think that works out to be 13 inches of snow for every inch of water that you have. In a heavy storm at Alta, they might see 12% water content. Heavy storm in say, the Sierra Nevada, on average, sees water contents that are around 12 or 13%.
Wow.
And then when you go
So Alta's 8.
Alta's around 8.4%.
Yep. So that's pretty dry.
It's pretty dry compared to the Sierra. But if you go to a Steamboat, the numbers are in the 7s, like 7.2 or 7.4% on average.
Huh.
So it's interesting.
Have you ever skied 6% snow?
I have. And, you know, even if anybody skis regularly in Utah, there are storms that produce all very low water content snow.
Yeah.
And the disadvantage with snow like that, say you get 10 inches of 6% water content snow, is there's not a lot of flotation of that snow. Usually you sink right through it.
So you don't necessarily want just dry stuff.
No, you don't want super dry stuff. If it's all dry, usually you're riding on the underlying snow surface a lot, and it's not as good.
Right.
People call it, say, for dust on crust, for example.
Yeah.
If you have 6 inches of, say, very low water content snow, you're just riding on the underlying snow surface. Looks great in pictures, good to post on Facebook, make your friends jealous. But it doesn't ski as good as, say, a storm that starts off with higher water content, maybe like 10 or 12%. And then it goes drier over time because then you get great flotation. Then you get the dry snow on top for face shots and everything else.
Where does Utah fit then in the U.S.? Because you mentioned in the book that there are these different climate regimes, and we're kind of somewhere in between. There's a transitional snow climate.
Yeah, we're in what some people call the intermountain snow climate or the transitional snow climate. So, you know, there's kind of two extremes in the snow climate business in North America. One's the maritime snow climate. So that's a warmer winters, deep snowpacks, lots of precipitation. The snowpack is usually near freezing for most of the winter. It doesn't get really cold.
Right.
That would be the Sierra Nevada, the Cascades, parts of British Columbia. And then the other extreme is the continental snow climate, which is going to be most of Colorado and parts of Wyoming. And there you're dealing with a thinner snowpack, less precipitation, and it's much colder. And then we're in the transition zone, so transitional intermountain. And so we're kind of in the sweet spot where we still get dry snow or drier snow, but we get lots of it. That's Utah. The Tetons are really transitional, parts of Wyoming and interior British Columbia. That's kind of the transitional snow climate.
So are we? So that's what makes us special. As you said, it's not just about the dryness of it. It's about the fact that we get a lot of it or enough of it and not too wet, not too dry. We'll talk about Japan in a minute because I think there's an interesting comparison there. But just in terms of the U.S., because, you know, people are looking for a way to brag to their friends still.
Right.
We are in a pretty great spot. We're in this kind of a Goldilocks spot.
Yeah, and the Cottonwoods, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole Wasatch Range doesn't get 500 inches of snow. The upper Cottonwoods are really a magical place. And, you know, and parts of the Tetons get that much snow, too. Like, if you go up to Grand Targhee, it's basically a very similar snow climate. And parts of interior British Columbia, although they're a little bit more, they do occasionally get more kind of what we call rhyming event, rain on snow events there because they're not quite as high. But that's that transitional snow climate, that place where they do get a lot of snow, and it's a pretty high quality snow.
Is there a difference between, like, I wonder how, I'm thinking about, you said the Cottonwoods, the canyons. Is Alta different? I mean, it's a little bit above Snowbird. How much different is the quality of snow there, and how does that compare, say, to the other canyons, which, like Brighton and Solitude?
Yeah. So, you know, the snowiest part of the Wasatch Range, there's two places where it snows the most in the Wasatch, and one is the area surrounding in Little Cottonwood Canyon and the high terrain surrounding Little Cottonwood Canyon.
Right.
And the other place is up to the north in the area around Ben Lomond Peak, north of Ogden. It's an extremely snowy location as well. As soon as you get out of the Little Cottonwood, the high terrain, those two high ridges that are south and north of Little Cottonwood, and you move into Big Cottonwood, then the snowfall numbers start to drop off. And when you get to the Park City Ridge line and you're, say, at Park City or Canyons Resort, you know, that area gets about 35 or 40% less snow for a given elevation compared to Little Cottonwood. So, you know, Little Cottonwood, and to a somewhat lesser degree, Big Cottonwood's still a very snowy place, but it doesn't snow quite as much as it does in Little Cottonwood. I mean, that's kind of the epicenter of great deep powder skiing in the Wasatch. And this was known in the book. If you take a look at it, there was a meteorologist. His name was S.D. Green. He was like
the
original Utah Interconnect backcountry skier. He and a few of the other hardcore backcountry skiers back then, they take a train to Park City. They would backcountry ski to Brighton and stay overnight there and then ski out the next day. But Green in the 1930s said eventually the world will learn that, you know, the best skiing is to be found in the upper Cottonwoods. And I think that's how things have played out.
Tell us about a man named Ed LaChapelle. Because you say in many ways he knew more about snow than anyone.
So Ed LaChapelle had a PhD. He had a tremendous scientific background. And he was an avalanche researcher at Alta back in the 50s and the 60s. And actually, the guy that brought him there was a guy named Monty Atwater. And Monty and Ed are responsible for a tremendous amount of work that's been done on avalanches in the United States. Ed was more of the scientist, so he was really into kind of the science and the physics of avalanches, but also did a lot of practical work in terms of avalanche control. And Monty Atwater, the guy that brought him there, he was the one that first started to use big artillery to do avalanche control work in Little Cottonwood. So back in the 40s, people wanted to ski powder. They didn't want to be stuck down here in the Salt Lake Valley knowing it's snowing up there. They wanted to get up the canyon, and people wanted to ski safe. So Monty talked the National Guard into bringing a 75-millimeter howitzer up there and started to use it for avalanche control work at Alta back in the 40s.
He was among the first, you said, to realize that the best deep powder skiing isn't just the lightest snow. He's one who talked about the body of snow. It's like it's more about the body than it is the lightness of it.
Yeah, I've read a lot of Ed's papers over the years, and I found one several years ago that he wrote in 1962 that said the best deep powder skiing isn't found in the driest snow, but with snow with the most body to allow good flotation for the running ski. And that's this stacking of the snow.
Yeah.
It's not real. You don't want all super dry snow. You want this kind of stacking of the snow from higher water content to lower water content for deep powder skiing.
So I want to break this down because there are three ingredients to great powder skiing. And you've sort of already talked a little bit about some of this, but first is the amount of snow. You have to have enough, you say, to give, as you said before, this sensation of floating. You want it to be powder, bottomless. But it can't be too deep, or it shouldn't be too deep. So how much of that qualifies as about the right amount of snow? You say it's about 10 inches to a foot.
Yeah, I consider about 10 inches to a foot is kind of the minimum before you start to get good bottomless skiing conditions. You know, at that point, depending on what the characteristics of the snow are, but that's a pretty good guess. At that point, you're starting to get real ski flotation where you're not riding on an underlying surface. And of course, you know, ideally, you want more than that.
Of course. But you need at least that.
But you don't want too much, because then the problem is when you get to be too much is that, you know, it's too dangerous to ski anything steep enough. You know, when you get a lot of snow, you got to be on a steep run to be able to keep your momentum going. And the problem is when you get a lot of snow, especially in a short period of time, then the avalanche conditions get to be a problem.
Yeah.
The resort either has to close their steep terrain or they have to close altogether. Or if you're in the backcountry, you got to be extremely cautious. So there's kind of a, like I said, a magic area in there where you can have too much of a good thing, you know, and I don't know exactly where that is. It depends on the avalanche conditions and that sort of thing. But somewhere in that 12 to 24, 28 or 30 inches of snow is kind of the sweet spot. And when you get up to 30, there's a pretty good chance it's too much of a good thing.
Yeah. Have you ever been in that?
I have. I skied at Crystal Mountain in Washington State when they had 65 inches of snow in 24 hours.
Wow.
And it was too much of a good thing. The only run that was open that you could even move on was, you know, you just would poke your head up now and then to see where you were going.
Right.
But it really wasn't great skiing. Yeah. People always think, oh, that would be amazing. But the best days I've had are more in the thigh deep variety than over your head powder.
The second ingredient, the underlying surface, that's another really important part of it.
Yeah, if you get a 12-inch snowstorm and it's falling on a really rock-hard, icy surface, you know, it might be enough that you never feel the bottom. But if you know, that an icy surface isn't as good as, say, something that's a little soft and spongy. And that's one of the reasons why the backcountry, when you get a storm, and it might not be a big storm, but you still might get really good powder skiing because the underlying snow surface there tends to be kind of a little bit softer.
And final ingredient, right side up snowfall. You want the lighter snow on the top, and it does work the other way around, and that's not as good.
Right. So the right side up storm, the lighter stuff is on top. You get great flotation. We get upside down storms, what I call upside down storms, and the Avalanche Center has always called them that too. Those are the ones where you start off maybe cold and you get dry snow to start, and then it gets warmer with time. And as a result, you get high-density snow on top of low-density, and so your skis tend to break through the high-density layer and they stay submerged. Now, some of the skis they make today, these big wide things that are 150 millimeters wide, those, I mean, that's another thing that can help out a little bit. Old schoolers like me that were skiing on 205 or 210 centimeter skinny skis, then we became a little more accustomed to all these details and nuances.
What are you skiing on these days?
I'm skiing on something that's about 179 or 180 centimeters, and it's about 95 millimeters wide in the waist. I still can't get on those big wide things. It's tough for me to do.
Like it's cheating or something, or just it's
no?
Not as
I
fun?
Just you know, at the resorts, At the resorts, I'm mostly skiing on non-powder days, so I don't necessarily want something really wide. And then in the backcountry, I don't want something that's too big because it wears you out too fast. So I ski on lighter weight equipment that allows me to do longer tours.
Yeah. Jim Steinberg is with us, professor of atmospheric science at the University of Utah. His book is called Secrets of the Greatest Snow on Earth, Weather, Climate Change, and Finding Deep Powder in Utah's Wasatch Mountains and Around the World. We'll get to the around the world part of his book when we get back from a break. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking to Jim Steinberg about the secrets of the greatest snow on Earth. That's the name of his book. It talks about weather and climate change and the characteristics of the really good stuff, powder, for example. Turns out it's not just light and airy stuff. It's more complicated than that. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call from, Micah is joining us in Salt Lake. Micah, hi.
Hi. I had a question about, ice climbing in Utah. I'm not an ice climber, but I was once traveling on a plane in Europe and was placed next to a young man who was a third generation ice climber. He was German. He had ice climbed all over the world. And when I told him I was from Utah, he was very excited. And I asked him if he'd ever ice climbed there. He said no, he'd rock climbed, but the conditions and the of ice and snow in Utah were so different from anywhere else that it was his opinion and the opinion of his community that his skills were wholly inadequate for ice climbing in Utah. And I was wondering what your comments were on that.
I guess it kind of goes to climate. Do you know anything at all about the characteristics of ice? I mean, you know a lot about snow.
It's a stretch for me. I ice climbing to me always seemed really cold. I always got the impression that kind of Ouray, Colorado was the center for ice climbing in the United States. But I have to kind of plead, I don't know the answer to that one because I don't know enough about ice climbing to really have a good understanding of what's going on there.
So this may surprise some people that one of the world's truly great snow climates is the west side of Japan's Honshu Island.
And Hokkaido.
And Hokkaido Island, which is that. I want to talk about both of those. Hokkaido Island, I guess, is almost as good as Utah in terms of its powder skiing or maybe better at times? I mean,
well, I think the snow climate in Japan might be the coolest snow climate in the world. It's an amazing place, and it's a different climate than we have here because it sits downstream of Asia.
Yeah.
And what happens in Japan is during the wintertime, what they call the winter monsoon, is cold air from Asia just is constantly pouring off the continent, and it's moving over the Sea of Japan, which is incredibly big and warm. So they basically get lake effect snow. It's forming over the Sea of Japan, but they're inundated in it during the so-called winter monsoon. And it peaks in December and January. And so their snowfall season's shorter than ours, but it's also more intense. And so in January on Hokkaido Island, there's a observing station that's about 500 feet above sea level, and they average almost 150 inches of snow in that month of January. You know, compared to Alta, which might be something like 85 to 90. So it's the surest bet for powder anywhere in the world probably would be Hokkaido Island in January.
Have you been?
I have been. I've skied on Honshu. I was there for the 1998 Olympics,
yeah.
Not as a competitor, but as a weather observer.
Yeah.
And you might remember they had a lot of snow during the games. It was a big problem. So I had a day I was supposed to be at the Super G and watching the Super G and meeting with a meteorologist there. And I met with the meteorologist, but they canceled all the events because it snowed like 20 inches. And So I was done for the day, so I threw my skis on and went up to the top and skied powder for 3 or 4 hours and had an amazing day. But yeah, Japan's an amazing place. It snows. There's places in Japan, northern part of Honshu, that are at sea level. They get 300 inches of snow a year. These are cities that have 300,000 people that live in them. So,
wow.
And Sapporo, where the Olympics were a few decades ago, that's the snowiest city with over 1 million people anywhere in the world. So a lot of people don't think of snow when they think of Japan, but it's one of the neatest snow climates around.
Are there any other places that surprised you as you were, because you do this kind of world scan of really great skiing places. Anything unexpected that you found?
Well, I think I've never been in the Southern Hemisphere, and I guess I was a little surprised that places like New Zealand, the skiing there is quite challenging. I guess you could say a lot of the resorts are built on the eastern side of New Zealand at relatively low elevation, and so I always figured that they'd have a really good snow climate there, but the resorts have extremely variable conditions. It can be really good, it can be terrible.
So when you say challenging, you mean it can be pretty crummy.
It can be bad.
Yeah.
It can be good. And
yeah.
Then, you know, when you get to a lot of where it snows a lot in New Zealand is very difficult to get to. And they have a very maritime snowpack. I mean, I'm sure there'd be an unbelievable place to spend some time there and do some skiing. But getting to places that really do get a lot of snow there is a little bit more challenging.
Yeah.
One of the things that's neat about New Zealand is they have all these ski areas that are these club, they call them these club fields. And you just have these, rope toes and El Cheapo kind of skiing, but you can access amazing terrain. And, you know, there are places like Temple Basin. That was the little ski field I found that gets quite a bit of snow. And you have to hike for 45 minutes just to get to the lift, you know? I mean, that's pretty old school.
Right. There's a question from Jim who wants to know about how the snow in the Patagonias stack up. I mean, that's another...
Yeah. So down in Patagonia, it's kind of the same issue. It's pretty maritime there, meaning that they get a lot of snow, but it also tends to be somewhat heavier. There's probably a few sweet spots in the Andes where you're kind of transitioning from the maritime, the western side, to the drier side in Argentina, where you can find some pretty good snow a lot of the time. And then, you know, a lot of the big resorts like Portillo and Valle Nevado and stuff that are up near in northern Chile,
yeah.
You know, they can get some good snow, but they have a more Southern California-type climate, so it's more feast or famine there to some degree, and they don't have the reliable conditions that we have here in Utah.
It's interesting. So you mentioned... lake effect in Japan and the effect that has on snow. I want to spend a little bit of time with the Great Salt Lake effect, which you describe in the book as probably a weather phenomenon that is misunderstood more than any other.
Yeah, I think the problem here is every time the wind blows out of the northwest and it snows, everybody assumes it's produced by the lake. And so a lot of people think that the lake is producing, I don't know, big numbers. A quarter or a half of the snow around here, but it's a much smaller number than that.
Like about 5%.
Yeah, it's
right?
About 5% in the cottonwoods of this precipitation that falls during the cool season from about September through April or May. And I think it's just because, again, a lot of times the lake effect is at the end of the storm and it produces a little bit, but a big chunk of the storm is produced by other processes. And then it can be important, though, because the lake effect peak is in October and November. That's when we actually get the most lake effect is in the fall.
Really?
Yes. It's not and we can get it in the spring, too, but that's and lake effect can happen any time of year. But if you look over about a 15-year period, it's October, November, that's the most lake effect. Some of that falls as rain in the valley.
Right.
But if you get one big event in November, it can really help you out to get the ski season started, because whether or not you have a good start to the ski season or bad is really dependent on whether or not you get a couple of those storms in November, which this year we really haven't had.
Yeah.
But so it can be important, but it's not as significant as most people think.
It raises the question of man-made snow, because when you don't have a great, which we didn't, fall, resorts are churning out man-made stuff. What's the quality of that, really?
Well, it depends on what you're looking for. It's not good for deep powder skiing in any way, shape, or form. I mean, man-made snow is it's not really what I consider to be snow. They blow it out of guns, and it basically are blowing very, very small liquid water droplets out that then freeze before they hit the ground. So it's more like really small man-made sleet, you could say. It's got extremely high density. So when you think about snow in the Sierras as being an average water content of 12%, man-made snow is over 20% water, and it can be in the high 20s. So it's really dense, but that's what you want. in a place like Utah to put down a really durable surface to get the place, you know, to get the ski area running. And it's why we have skiing, you know, in a low snow year like this. A place like Park City or the canyons would probably have nothing open or very little. But now they're able to have some terrain open because of snowmaking. And one of the funny things about Utah is we have great snow, but we also have great snowmaking conditions here usually. Once you're into, you know, it's very dry.
Yeah.
I mean, we do get warm and it can make it a little difficult, but for the most part, it's really dry here and it can be quite cold, especially at night. And that's great for snowmaking. So we have good snowmaking conditions here.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. John with us in Salt Lake. John, hi.
Hi, how are you? Hey, it's a good show. A couple of quick comments before the question. Mount Lyford, North Canterbury. I lived in New Zealand. That was my club field, and incredible skiing most of the time, so for 3 years. Second thing, I wish you could get the 95 inches of snow you mentioned for January for Alta, so put in a request for that. Third, could you please talk about the differences that you can experience in quality of snow depending on the orientation of the slope? I mean, I've been in the Wasatch and skied one section of a ridgeline and then kind of went over the hump and got on just a few yards away from another aspect, and the snow was totally different. And maybe you could talk about that. And
yeah. Yeah, that'll have to go into book number two, I guess, because I didn't cover that in the book. But what you're talking about there is the effects of aspect. And, boy, if you're a backcountry skier, you really notice that all the time. And some of that's related to wind exposure. So one side of the hill can have a lot of snow scoured off of it, and it gets deposited on the other side. Another issue is sun exposure. And so you don't – I always tell people what you really want for a great backcountry ski season here is a lot of snow early in the year, because November, December, and January is the lowest sun angle part of the year. And right. So you can ski a lot of aspects for a long time. But then when you start to get into February, then the sun angle starts to get pretty high, and all of a sudden the south aspects get baked really fast. Snow conditions can be a lot worse there, say, than on the northern side if it's been a couple days since a storm. So those things can be really important, and for backcountry travelers, it's very important for assessing avalanche conditions, because you can walk just a couple feet from one side of a ridge to another, and you have a totally different snowpack and a totally different avalanche condition.
It's interesting. I mean, you really have to... if you really want to understand the experience and get the right experience, you have to understand a lot of these. And I guess probably good skiers probably do to some degree, right? I mean, they're pretty good about the conditions.
Yeah, most skiers know where on the hill to find snow under certain conditions, people that are really avid about it. And so, yeah, even at the resorts, you know, there are certain parts of the mountain under certain conditions that snow tends to hold up better. So
I wanted to ask you about... so far the ski year, as you're looking, and this is one thing we'll probably come back to this. You mentioned it's hard to predict whether or not we're going to have a, you know, you get the almanac, tells you can have a good snow year or whatever. You always mentioned it's hard to talk about, but what we've seen so far, not a lot of moisture really at all. Does that give you any indication about what the ski season is going to be like? And I mean, is it?
No, I mean, it's hard to seasonal prediction in Utah in the northern Wasatch is pretty difficult.
Yeah.
There's not a lot that correlates with what's going to happen in a given winter here. I mean, the bread and butter of seasonal forecasting is whether or not you're in an El Nino year or a La Nina year. And, you know, that correlates with the precipitation in the southwest United States and to some degree in the northwest, but we're kind of in the middle.
Right.
And so it's kind of a crapshoot here. And the line I always use is, don't worry about it. A bad year here is better than a good year in Colorado. at least in the Cottonwoods, that's definitely the case. But on the other hand, the hard part now is if somebody were to say, are we going to have a below average year? I'd say, well, the odds favor that because we've been below average now for 6 weeks. On the other hand, Mother Nature can bring it really fast.
Yeah.
And so we could things by the time we get to the end of April, who knows where we're going to end up. So ski it if it's white. I guess that's the moral to the story.
Jim Steinberg is with us, professor of atmospheric science at the University of Utah. His book is called Secrets of the Greatest Snow on Earth, Weather, Climate Change, and Finding Deep Powder in Utah's Wasatch Mountains and Around the World. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Jim Steinberg. We're talking about his book, Secrets of the Greatest Snow on Earth. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So I wanted to talk about the conditions of Utah snow. This always comes up. We were mentioning this off air. How is climate change going to affect all of this? Help us get our bearings, first of all, because you point out in the book that it's, of course, it's warmer today than when lift-served skiing first came to Utah in the middle of the 20th century. But here's the big question. Is it significantly warmer, like to the point where it's having a consistent effect on the quality of the skiing experience?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Let's take it a step back and say what we know now. And, okay. Of course, you know, keeping in mind that there's a lot of fluctuations that happen because of weather. But what we can see is that, yes, it's warmer. We live in a warmer climate today than there was 50 years ago or 100 years ago. And I think for the state of Utah, the past decade was probably about 2 degrees warmer than it was 100 years ago. So there's a number to kind of hang on there.
Got it.
And the other thing that we can see happening now is a greater fraction of the precipitation that falls during the wintertime at lower elevations, right, probably below elevations of about 7,000 feet or so, is falling as rain instead of snow. It hasn't been a huge change, but we've seen a slight trend towards, okay, more precipitation is falling as rain instead of snow. And the good news for Utahns right now is that our upper elevations are, it's a pretty cold climate up there. And as a result, when you go to a place like Alta or Snowbird, they still have pretty great skiing there all season long. And we haven't had it. I consider that to be a less vulnerable altitude, is your friend, so to speak, a less vulnerable climate.
It's colder, higher you go.
Right, yeah. For snow. So, you know, we're in the early stages of climate change here. And so as things accelerate during the 21st century, we're going to continue to see these trends. We're going to continue to see warming, and that loads the dice. It means that it's more likely we're going to have an above-average temperature winter than a below-average temperature winter. And events like we've had this December where we've gotten, say, 2 weeks of really warm weather, the frequency of those is going to be higher than really cold weather like we had a couple of years ago in January, people might remember.
Right.
So it's a loading of the dice. And then we're going to start to see more of our lowland precipitation falling as rain instead of snow. And how the upper elevations get affected is really just depends on how much the climate warms. And that's a function of how high the greenhouse gas concentrations go, and then how fast and how much the Earth's climate system responds to that increase.
You explain in the book that for a temperature rise of 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, about 10% of the precipitation that currently falls as snow is going to fall as rain instead at 7,000 feet.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Is that right? Okay, so that's a problem if that's going to be a problem for Park City and for the canyons, and that's going to be a problem for Deer Valley. I mean, their base elevation is 7,000 feet.
Yeah, so the way I think about this is the lower elevations are more vulnerable to climate change than the higher elevations, all else being equal. If there's
right.
not a major shift in the storm track, everybody could be sunk. But in terms of the temperature rise, it's the lower elevations that are vulnerable. Or if you're like me and you like to cross-country ski some, you know, it's already difficult to find a decent season length at a place like Mountain Dell on the golf course
right.
there. And that's going to become increasingly a challenge as we move forward.
Because that's going to be rain.
Yeah. And it's
not going
to happen necessarily overnight. It might be, you know, in the next couple of decades, we're going to start to see this emerging. We're going to start to see more of these funky years at the lower elevations than we're seeing, you know, the last couple of decades.
But at 9,500 feet, that number that you mentioned, only 3% of that is going to. So Alta, still in decent shape. Snowbird, still in decent shape. Even some of the upper elevations, Deer Valley, Park City, I mean, they should be.
Yeah, they're going to see their snowpack. What is going to affect them from year to year is just whether or not we get storms. Like
right.
this year, the fact that there's below average snowpack at Mid-Mountain at Snowbird this year is simply because we haven't had storms. It hasn't been because it's been raining all the time. So for that part of the world, they're just dependent on whether or not we get the storms in the first wave of warming. And then as it warms more and more and more, then they might start to see a little bit more of the wintertime precipitation falling as rain instead of snow.
So this question comes up. If it is a myth that it's the dry and light stuff that makes for good powder skiing, what effect is a warming planet going to have on the quality of our powder in
I think
any way of knowing?
Yeah, we would expect that the water content of the snow here would increase over time. Warmer storms produce wetter snow. And as we see more warmer storms, we're going to start seeing more snow that's wetter. So I would expect that the quality would decrease some. However, if you think about it, it's still going to be better snow than you find many other places. There are, you know, the upper cottonwoods have a certain, they're going to be one of the places where the ski industry can continue to survive. Whereas other parts of the world will start to see a greater loss of ski resorts. And I've read some stuff recently, you know, like even in the Northeast, you know, even with warming over the next 100 years, they think there will be some resorts at higher elevation that will continue to operate through the century, but they lose about half of their resorts with warming in the 21st century.
So but people must come to you all the time wringing their hands about the quality of their powder. Like, this, it sucks now. It's not like it was. And you're probably a little circumspect about that.
Well, I think, I think it depends. People are really strongly influenced by what's happened in recent past. And, you know, we had a tremendous year. Was it 2010-11? I can't remember, 3 years ago. I mean, we had 800 inches of snow at Snowbird, and it was an amazing year. So Mother Nature can still bring it.
Right.
She'll be back. Don't worry. She will be back.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take another call. John with us in Salt Lake. John, hi.
Yeah. I was wondering if you had looked at the density trends in the Cottonwood Canyon. So how the density compared in the last decade compared to the decade 50s or 60s, for example?
I don't know if there's a good enough data set to do that. There could be. The data sets that I have access with, good snowfall data sets, they go back about 25 or 30 years. Being a meteorologist, I consider that to be a pretty short time series to really look at the overall trend, because these year-to-year fluctuations from weather kind of obscure the long-term noise. And I would expect, I can't remember the numbers, but a couple degrees of warming would only shift the water contents by a small amount. It might be very hard to detect. So I guess I have to plead ignorance on that as well.
But the really important question is whether what effect this is going to have on precipitation on our water years. I mean, everyone's looking at this drastic drought in California, and people are wondering if we can anticipate what to anticipate in terms of water. I mean, on some levels, you talk about northern regions are going to become more wet.
Yeah. The thing I like to tell people is there's a lot of different computer models that we run to try to figure out what's going to happen. And they all are calling for warming, but some of them call for a wetter climate for us in the wintertime, and some of them call for a drier climate. And that makes our trying to figure out what's going to happen around here more difficult. I think the important thing to remember is that if we go back and look at tree rings and these other kinds of records of what's happened over the West for 1 or 2,000 years, is that we have built into our climate system pretty severe drought that appears from time to time, multi-decadal stuff, worse than anything we've seen in the 20th century. So building a resilient system in which we're prepared for this sort of thing makes sense, you know, even if we're not sure what's going to happen during the 21st century.
Let's take another call from, speaking of Alta, Chris is with us in Alta. Chris, hi.
How's it going?
Great.
It's snowing up here a little bit. Hey, I want to ask you, since you just mentioned the storm track, you know, the sort of mean position of the storm track winter to winter seems to be a really big factor in determining whether we have a snowpack or don't have a snowpack. And I wonder if there's anything definitive you can say about climate change's effect on whether we have the storm track here in the Great Basin or not.
That's a great question. I mean, you do address the storm characteristics, storm tracks, all of that.
Yeah, I think it's a hard question to answer because, like I said, the models don't fully agree on what's going to be happening around here. I think they do agree that in Utah is actually affected by two storm tracks in the sense of there's a northern jet that tends to be, you know, we're in a split a lot of the time. And one of the reasons why we do get snow here is we sometimes get stuff from the northern branch of the jet, and we sometimes get stuff from the southern branch of the jet. I think most of the models suggest the storm tracks are going to retreat northward. Mm-hmm. So we might see a decrease in the frequency of storms, but because it's warmer, the atmosphere holds more moisture, we might see a shift to more bigger storms. So even though the storm track is swung to the north a little bit, we see fewer storms, but they're bigger and they're bigger in intensity and duration.
So if you're in Alta, you're in good shape. Could be.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it like I said, I'm thinking out loud a little bit here, and I don't think we have confidence to make definitive statements now If we look at a lot of the average of what the computer models output, they actually call for it to be wetter here than it is right now. That's where they show a slight, but there are some models that dry it out. So
yeah.
We just haven't, we don't have a good consensus there yet.
And you also say the climate models are not really able to resolve the effects of the Wasatch Mountains in the Great Salt Lake.
And this is another problem. Yeah, these climate models, they have to be run, they have to run 100 years into the future with very sophisticated equations and physics that have to be solved on a computer. And we have to chunk the Earth up now into these big blocks that don't allow us to see, say, what the Cottonwoods look like. In fact, they don't even see the Wasatch or the Uinta Mountains. So as scientists, we try to come up with techniques to get around that. But ideally, we want to have computer models that directly resolve our terrain effects.
Yeah.
Until then, that's still a source of uncertainty for our work.
Running out of time, but I do have to mention what you call the dirty little secret of Utah's powder, which, of course, is dust. I mean, greenhouse gases gets a lot of the attention. But you say that dust could have a profound effect on Utah's snow climate.
Well, it's already having a profound effect. If you've been in the Wasatch in the spring the last few years, you see dust on the snow.
Yep.
It darkens the snow. The snow absorbs more sunlight, and it melts earlier, and it melts faster.
Well, this is the thing that's interesting, though. You said that studies in the San Juan Mountains of Colorado suggest that dust decreases the duration of snow cover. And this stunned me. It decreased the duration of snow cover by between 30 to 50 days.
Yeah, depending on the year and how much dust they have. It's a pretty substantial change. And the San Juan dust is darker than ours, so I'm not sure that our impact is that large. But it's definitely, I would imagine that eventually somebody's going to start running computer models and we're going to see something like a duration of snow cover here is advanced by or decreased by maybe 2 or 3 weeks.
So final question, about a minute left. It's good to know how this all works. Don't panic a little too much, but there is reason to worry, I guess. I mean, what sort of takeaway from all of this as you think about it?
Well, I think I try to tell people a couple of things. One is that ski it if it's white.
Yeah.
I think it's important. You know, my personal views are we need to be moving to a lower carbon way of producing energy for a lot of reasons. And one of them is that we're playing Russian roulette basically with the Earth's climate system. But I think for my lifetime, and I think we're going to continue to have good snow here, and we shouldn't panic because we've had a couple of bad snow years. I think it's mainly because the storm track hasn't been favorable, and Mother Nature is going to eventually bring it for us.
Jim Steinberg, his book is Secrets of the Greatest Snow on Earth, Weather, Climate Change, and Finding Deep Powder in Utah's Wasatch Mountains and Around the World. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our theme music composed by The Moth and the Flame. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.